Welcome to the Animal Voices radio show here on 100.5 FM, Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, January 18th, 2013. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Jackie McIntosh.
Hello.
And our guest co-host, Jenny Rempel.
Hey.
Hey, Jenny. I think, okay, say hi again.
Hello.
There we go. Welcome.
Now we're in business.
Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan-related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage the movement toward a world in which animals are treated with compassion and mercy and are afforded the respect that humans take for granted. This program can be heard every Friday from noon till 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at coopradio.org and available as podcasts on iTunes and at animalvoices.org after airing. So for our first main segment today, Jackie will be presenting a piece called Effective Responses to Common Vegan Arguments. Jackie, do you want to say a little bit about what you'll be speaking about?
Well, I think we all have omnivorous or carnivorous people in our family or friends, and we always hear those negative responses to hearing that we're vegan or just the vegan lifestyle. So I just have some responses that are informative and well-educated responses to not make you sound overly emotional.
And we're all going to actually give our own responses, so looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. For our feature interview today, we have author, attorney, and animal advocate Sharon Discorfano on the show to speak with us about coping after the loss of a companion animal. In 2009, Sharon lost her beloved beagle, Pushkin, and as part of her healing process, she wrote daily letters to him during the period of Lent, which have now been published into a very touching book called Letters to Pushkin. I've been reading this book these past few weeks and have been really enjoying the experience of Sharon sharing her thoughts and self-expressions during this incredibly difficult time for her. I think that anyone who has experienced loss, whether it be of a human or non-human animal, can really relate to her words, and even more so, I think that reading her articulate and poignant letters can serve as a healing tool in advance of anyone facing loss. So whether or not you have endured the loss of a furry or non-furry friend yet, it's pretty much an inevitable fact of life and something that will come soon enough for everyone. So I think it's valuable to communicate with each other about these things so that the healing process will come easier when the time comes to face it. And just to give you an idea of what the content of this beautiful book entails, Letters to Pushkin, I wanted to read an excerpt from the book so that you can get a feel of Sharon's form of self-expression. So here we go. When I was holding you, wrapped up in your favorite blanket and your exhausted beagle body finally was giving your spirit over to those initial stages of dissolution, I just kept saying, I'm right here, Pushkin. We're right here with you. Your dad, grandpa, and grandma were in the room with us. After about 30 seconds, the doctor checked your heartbeat. It was still beating slowly and softly. You weren't quite ready. In these last few moments, you were still. I kept reassuring you until the doctor checked a second time, and I just sat there and breathed with you. I was determined not to cry. I wanted to surround you with peace. I'd like to think that when you next opened your eyes to whatever one first sees when he crosses that threshold, that you could still hear my words, and the sound of my voice followed you like a faint echo, a gentle whisper in your ear, and that my voice still had the power to soothe you and make you feel safe and loved. Just like during those first conversations and songs we shared while you were still undergoing treatment at the Baidoe Center before I could officially adopt you and bring you home. Whether you're now soaring over a seemingly endless ocean, are hanging out with the angels warming up for choir practice, or are now a million lights dazzling in the sky above us, I hope you can still hear me and that whatever sadness you detect in my voice doesn't trouble you, and that you already have incorporated the sound of my voice, if not my whole ethereal self, somehow into your personal heaven. Love, Mom. So what do you think?
Wow.
It's a really sweet. It's a really beautiful book. And Jenny, you wanted to speak with us about companion animals who have touched our lives.
Yeah, I think, at least myself personally, I always grew up having cats in the house. And more recently, we've adopted some cats that some of our neighbors have abandoned in our neighborhood. I think it's a really great way to fill your house with more love and more caring. But I think that book and the excerpts I've read from it have really touched me because myself, when I was younger, one of our cats had to be put down on Christmas Eve because he had a really extreme type of cancer, and it was like very uh-huh. painful for him to continue living. I was just really affected, especially by the segment you just read that I thought was really powerful, because I know sometimes, like for myself when I was young, we couldn't even be in the room, or like we could have, but it was too much because I was quite little at the time. So
you mean while they were being put to sleep?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I would never. I don't even know how my mom did it with three
wow.
dogs. Because yeah. especially our last one was just like the light of our life, and she just hasn't even recovered from that yet. Even like that's been 3 years ago now, and mm. Neither her or my dad are actually going to get another companion animal. They said because it's just because no other dog can measure up to Penny, and because it's just too painful when you know it's time for them to go. And I don't even know how. People can watch that. I mean, Jackie, you mm-hmm. you see this a lot, don't you, in your job?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an emotional thing for a lot of people, but I think you have to understand that you are doing the kindest thing that you can for these animals, most of the time, at least, when they're at that point. And when my latest cat that I grew up with as a child had to be euthanized recently, I was Aww. Present for that. It was, wow. there was lots of tears.
So you had this cat for a really long time.
Yeah, I got him when I was 8 or 9, and he lived to be about 16, I think, something like that.
Wow.
So yeah, it was a large portion of my life. The past few years, I wasn't living with him because I had moved out, but mm-hmm. I still definitely spent all of my childhood years like side by side with him. So that was a very emotional thing for me to deal with, but I think the thing is, you have to, if you're able to be there with the animal, you have to kind of try to.
No, well, someone needs to.
You
be
have
there.
To withhold yeah, your emotions because they feel that in
That's
the very end.
That's what Sharon
end.
Said. Is I exactly. you know, resolve myself not to cry.
Exactly.
You're right because you don't want the last.
Exactly.
Because as Jackie and I were speaking about before the show, is animals are so intuitive.
They are. Mm-hmm.
They
yeah.
can sense what you're feeling. Right. Perhaps
yeah.
they can't. Perhaps they can't talk in human language to
you can tell
to communicate
though,
with them,
know.
But you know that. I mean, the dogs that we've had, you know that they. Know
I remember
how you're feeling.
Like withholding my tears, yeah. and then the minute he was gone, I just like burst into tears.
He's probably still around,
yeah,
watching you,
yeah. So that was an emotional time, but
I think that takes like a special kind of courage and bravery, or not a
yeah.
special kind, but like you need to conjure that within yourself
exactly.
and really bring that strength to be able to, mm-hmm. to do that. I think
it must be one of the hardest because we don't put people to sleep. You know that people,
well,
you know, not usually.
That's a whole other issue.
Yeah. What I mean is pretty much whenever a companion animal is taken from us, it's when the guardian decides that now's the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's and you're right, you need to conjure up that strength, and I just don't know how I would ever do that, and I don't know how my mom does it, like because she's always like been the main nurturer of our animals, right? And except for our first pet, Willie, she was a chicken. She actually got killed by a dog, but then we had three dogs after that, and I don't know how she ever, like, she had to make the decision, okay, today's the day, and I was never around for that. Actually, I was around for our first, oh, no, I wasn't. I was already left home for all three of those dogs, actually, so mm-hmm. I don't know how people do it. It's just an amazing strength that you're, as you say, you have to find within yourself.
I think just the whole topic of dealing with grief and with death mm-hmm. is a challenging thing, but I think it's interesting that animals do it too, because I remember at one point I had a little kitten who had gotten sick, the one who had had to be euthanized on Christmas mm-hmm. Eve, and we had another cat, and she missed him so much when he was gone. Like, you could tell she would go looking for him, and even when he was sick and he was in pain, like, they had a relationship going on. So it was really interesting to observe that, even within the animals themselves.
Well, and it's interesting too, like when one animal is suffering or sick, oftentimes the other pet, be that a dog
or
a cat,
after, right?
It doesn't matter. Like that's such a strong point of like anti-speciesism, is like a dog will support a cat through a tough time, a cat will support a dog or a rabbit. It's just, it's amazing how animals are so in tune to
a dog will support a human.
Exactly. That's the most common one,
animals,
probably.
Or animals don't care. I mean, that's just a wonderful, if you're my Facebook friend, which both of you are, whenever I see the cross species love, I'll always post that a picture of
that so powerful
on my Facebook, because whenever you see, I don't know, the last one I saw was like it was like an elephant with a goat or something like that that I read about recently. It was just amazing. Animals don't discriminate.
Well, I have a dog, a big shepherd mix, and she thinks she's a cat because she lives with two cats, and they
and dogs think they're humans.
They
often
love each other. They are always there to support each other through everything, and chasing each other, playing with each other. It's amazing.
There's a great book on that, and I don't remember the title, but you can find it at most like Loving Hut affiliated restaurants, and it's about like animals that are friends unexpectedly. But it is adorable and full of lots of photos and stories.
Well, Jonathan Balcombe has a book called The Exultant Ark that came out a couple years ago.
Oh, okay.
I haven't seen it at the Loving Hut pizza place here, but maybe that is the book that you're talking about. It's so what he did, we've had him on the show before, if anyone wants to look him up and listen to one or two wonderful interviews that we've had with him. I think we've interviewed him once. So The Exulting Ark, it's a picture book. It's like a coffee table book, and it's got all the different, actually, because I'm email friends with him. Well, I would send him photos of, because I know that this is like his niche and this is what he wants to do. This is a real interest of him, is just like interspecies emotions and that. So, you know, whenever you get emails and you forward them on of all these different like interspecies relationships, I would send them on to him and he would ask me, oh, do you know what the sources are? I want to put this in my book. So The Exultant Ark. So yeah.
That's awesome. Great recommendation. Mm-hmm. I think speaking of great recommendations, that brings us into our events segment now. So I've got some hot events for you guys. First off, ooh, yeah, spicy. This week we have two events from the Love Club based out of Simon Fraser University. On Monday, January 21st, there will be a vegan bake sale at SFU Surrey in the mezzanine from 10:30 a.m. to 12:20 p.m., and that's located right near the Surrey Central SkyTrain station for those of you in the Metro Vancouver area. The bake sale will be totally vegan and will be benefiting Hearts on Noses Mini Pig Sanctuary in Maple Ridge.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and then they're doing another event this Friday, actually, January 25th. There's going to be a screening of The Best Speech You Will Ever Hear by Gary Yourofsky at the SFU Burnaby campus at 2:30 p.m. The room is to be announced, but updates will appear on the Facebook event page, and if you search up the Love Club onto Facebook, you can get onto that. They're both open to the public. We've got some more fun stuff coming up. On January 25th, 3G Vegetarian Restaurant will be doing a fundraiser to benefit Liberation BC. There's going to be dinner between 4:30 and 9 p.m., and they'll be donating 30% of all dinner proceeds for purchases over $15 to Liberation BC.
Are you going to that?
I am undecided at this point.
So I asked you both to another dinner event that night before I knew this one was on, which I've already committed to.
The dinner competition.
Yeah, there's the dinner at Dao restaurant, at raw vegan place in North Van. Yeah, that's
okay, going
to be really good, too. That's on Vancouver Meatless Meetup at meetup.com.
Oh, okay,
so, yeah, I mean, I would be leaning more towards, if I had to decide again, the 3G, because it's a fundraiser for Liberation BC, and that's a really good cause. And I've actually been craving wanting to go there. So if you guys don't go, let's just all go together sometime.
Yeah.
I need people to go with.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, regardless of where you choose to go, I hope you're going somewhere on January 25th, because
definitely,
it appears that's a happening day to be munching around town.
To be vegan.
And I might also add to that is that night, and I think the night after, Sarah Rivers, who owns the Fairy Cakes Vegan Cupcakery, so a local business that we should support, she's in a band, and she's going to be singing in her Motown band that night. So I don't remember the name of the band, but
I think they're... Yeah. Oh, I know it, but I...
Okay, anyways.
say
hoping to head out to that after the dinner. So anyone else can do that too. Whatever dinner you're
the
going
singles.
To.
Singles. They're called the singles.
Yes, the singles. Mm, okay. Look it up on Facebook or something or on Fairy Cakes. There's a Facebook event for it. My friend and I are going to try to check that out afterwards.
Personally stalk her and that's how you can find.
Nice. No, I'm
kidding. Just call her at Fairy Cakes and
that
ask her for
too.
The details. I'm sure
Jenny
she wants people to go.
Awesome. We also have another event coming up. The Association for the Protection of Fur-Bearing Animals is having a volunteer night on Wednesday, January 30th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at their office at 179 West Broadway in Vancouver, B.C. They're in need of some assistant doing their mailouts for their direct mail campaign to over 500 people across the country, and there will be refreshments. If you want to sign up, you just need to email Andrea at furbearerdefenders.com or check out their website for more info on that one. And, of course, we have another exciting event coming up that Animal Voices radio show is actually sponsoring. We have Vancouver Animal Advocacy Camp coming up on February 23rd and 24th, 2013, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The venue is currently to be announced, but we'll be telling you the information as it comes to us shortly in the next few weeks.
Yeah, it should be even sooner than that.
I'm hoping soon.
By next week. Yeah,
By next week. But it's an opportunity for Vancouver activists to get together and learn from each other's experience and build a stronger community of animal advocates. Advanced registration is required, so to keep informed on the event and to register, please go to their website at animaladvocacycamp.ca. They also have a Facebook page that you can join. That's Vancouver Animal Advocacy Camp, so you can keep in touch and get more updates there.
Yeah, I encourage you people to join the Facebook group, especially if you're going to the event, because that's how we're going to be connecting afterwards for the whole year, just as a way to chat with each other.
Because and we're all on it.
You're both on it?
Yeah,
excellent.
I am.
Good, good. Yeah,
because
I think I invited you to it because I started that group. So.
And we have one more event coming up, I'm sure many more, but the Vancouver Vegan Prom will be taking place on March 9th at Wise Hall. So that's a bit far in the future, but it will be a great 19-plus event to have a vegan superhero party and dress up as Kale or come as your super self. Tickets aren't yet on sale, but they'll be coming
out soon. Kale is a superhero. You're right. I want to make
a super food.
I'm
going
to make
super
a cape made of kale.
Actually, confession, after the prom last year, I was walking by Wise Hall, and I saw this couple, and they were both dressed as trees, and I was like, I want to be you. You're so cool. So I hope they attend the event this year, whoever they are.
Go ahead. You can say it. Use the F word. We say it live on the radio. Maybe you've heard. Mondays at noon, we go for an hour. We talk about culture, gender, race, class, and power. We're bringing sexy back under attack. Cause it's about time folks started taking some flack for promoting a culture where you must be a pessimist. If you want to speak your mind, then say something feminist. But we know it's not true. From the truth you can't run. Feminists simply have so much more fun. If the trash that you hear makes you angry or bored, check out the F word at feminisms.org.
So you are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada. All right, so now it's time for our first segment on effective responses to common vegan arguments. And I'm sure, well, most of the people listening to the show are probably vegan, so you've probably had some of these responses.
I don't know about that. I hope our audience is just general.
Exactly. Well, you get something out of this. Either you're one to, you know, initiate the arguments or you're one to defend the arguments. Either way, I do have a few arguments here that I personally have heard quite a lot and I've done a lot of research on, so I have some hopefully intelligent sounding responses too, and I'm looking for some input from you guys as well. So the first one that is actually surprisingly common is we have much more important things to worry about. What about all the poverty and starvation in the world? Well, starvation is directly linked to meat consumption. The grain that is unnecessarily used to feed your food animals could be used to feed everyone suffering from starvation in the world. As a vegan, we are concerned about all animals, including humans and our planet. For more info on this, you can look at our interview with A Well-Fed World on December 9th.
Yeah, that was Don Moncrieff, mm-hmm. who was so that interview I did in honor of the International Human Rights Day, which just goes to show that all issues that people might think are so important, more important than animal rights issues, they're all interrelated, right? And as I was saying before the show, I just I was at the library just right before the show here, and there was a Humane Society of the United States magazine for sale at the library for 25 cents. I didn't buy it. I wanted to, but I have so many magazines. But I was flipping through it, and they had a segment on, or a feature on, Jane Velez Mitchell, who's a wonderful animal activist and host of Issues with Jane Velez Mitchell on HLN Network. So she does a lot of animal advocacy in her news stories. And anyways, she's saying, there's a quote on there, it's in big letters, "I'm a vegan because I care about human suffering. I'm a vegan because I care about the environment. I'm a vegan because I care about global warming. I'm a vegan because I care about human hunger." So if you care about all these large, large issues, go vegan and care about animals. It's all related.
It's all so interconnected, and a lot of people just think, oh, they just care about animals. They don't care about anything else. But no, we care. I think, I shouldn't generalize, but I think most vegans just are anti-exploitation and just are wanting to help the environment and help, you know, all animals, including humans, like I mentioned. And my next one is, animals were put on this planet for our consumption. Why should we not use what is given to us? So, animals are on this planet for no reasons other than their own. They are here to live their lives in their own ways and fulfill their needs. The world has a fine balance of various life forms, and humans are constantly wreaking havoc and tipping the balance. Animals have lived before us and will go on living after us. It is us that needs them. What do you think about that, Jenny, Allison?
I find that pretty interesting because that's something I've actually come up against several times. And I remember one time, I have like various internal religious beliefs, but I was at a church service for whatever reason, and I had visited the Sunday school part, and this woman brought out these doves, and she was showing the doves to the kids. And then she said, "And these are our food that God gave us." And I said, "No, they're so pretty. Why would you eat them?" And I really didn't know how to respond to that. But I think what you said is a good starting point. But I think also pointing out, like would you eat your dog? Like, how do you... Sometimes I think asking questions is helpful, at least for myself. Like, how do you decide which animals to eat?
And pigs are smarter than dogs. Mm.
Well, I personally think... So what your statement was animals are here for us to use, right? Was that correct?
That was the statement
So I personally feel that animals are here... We are all animals. We're all here for our own purposes, and we're all here to live. And as I was saying before, we're not here... An animal or any individual being is not born to die. Yeah. Like, that just doesn't make sense, right? They have their own thoughts, their own feelings, their own experiences that they should experience in their world, their own desire, and they just desire to live. People... Yeah. Individuals and all beings. So they are not here for any other species to, as you said, quote unquote, use. It doesn't make sense.
No. And spinning off of that, another argument that we get is, it's natural for us to eat meat. It's the circle of life. First of all, there is absolutely nothing natural about the meat production industry of today. Factory farming is about as far from nature as anything can get. And scientifically, it's been proven that everything from our jaw structure to our digestive systems are much more closely related to herbivores than carnivores. If we were meant to eat meat, we would have huge canines and be able to kill and rip apart prey without the use of machinery and technology.
Yeah, so what does natural mean? What do people mean? I think that's what you were getting at, is it's natural for us to go out and... hunt our animals and...
But who does that anymore?
No one does that. That's sort of more the natural. It's not... Yeah.
Some people do that, mm-hmm. especially with the popularity of the paleo diet rising. That's why sometimes I've found in my travels that people who follow the paleo diet, I sometimes have a really hard time conversing with about these topics, because some people just really strongly believe that they should go out and kill animals.
Yeah, and the scientific research behind that whole diet is so... so skewed, and if you like read from both sides, it's like, yeah.
I have to say though that in order for meat to be palatable, we need to first cook it. Mm-hmm. We need to throw a ton of barbecue sauce and seasonings and spices on it. Is that natural? You know, what is natural? And not only that, is we are an evolving society, right? So the word natural, I don't, it sort of doesn't really mean anything to me because what is that? What relevance does the natural have? What is natural, right? And as you first said, is factory farming is not natural. It's
There's
the most unnatural form of obtaining food source, other than growing it in your garden. That's what natural would be.
Yes, exactly.
I think it's important to keep in mind, though, when you're using the word natural on the flip side, like if you're trying to tell someone that eating plants is natural, that can also have problems with it. So
it's all interpretation. So this is another question that I get, actually. This is probably one of my more common ones I get, which I don't understand why. I am vegetarian, but I still eat fish. I mean, they're just fish. So fish are intelligent animals who, too, experience a great deal of suffering. Anatomically, physiologically, and biologically, the pain system in fish is virtually the same as in birds and mammals. Dragged from the ocean depths, fish undergo excruciating decompression. The intense internal pressure ruptures their swim bladders, pops out their eyes, and pushes their stomachs through their mouths. In addition, many non-target fish, seals, or even dolphins are caught in fishing nets. Also, many fish are from fish farms where they have little to no room to move around, and as such are swimming in their own filth, diseased, and covered in lice. Many species of fish are also endangered due to overfishing, and this industry is just awful for our environment all around. Additionally, by supporting the Canadian fishing industry, you are, by default, supporting the Canadian seal hunt, as it is the same industry. Plus, and also, like, to get all your omegas, you just can consume flax or hemp seeds or sea vegetables. You don't need to
get them from where the fish get them from, the algae, right? The algae. So one thing is, if people are interested in getting more information on the various different issues with fishing on a global scale, I recommend listening to an interview that I did last year. It was last January. It was aired with Charles Clover on global overfishing. That's really interesting. And then what you had originally said is, I'm a vegetarian, but I eat fish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're not a vegetarian.
Exactly.
Just put that out there.
Fish, I know
a
lot of fish eating vegetarians.
And fish don't feel pain? I don't believe that. And
it's been proven they do. They feel excruciating pain.
And when you're talking about the decompression, when they come up to the, everyone knows about decompression, and when you're diving or swimming or whatever, is you've got to pop your ears.
It's the opposite
that.
Thing.
So that's why the eyes of fish pop out if anyone's ever gone fishing, like you can tell, like they're not. And I used to go fishing a lot with my parents. I don't think I actually did it, and it was just the most horrible thing, just to see them there trying to breathe and gasp air
and
they couldn't breathe.
They can't scream, but they're silent screams, and it's not.
Right.
And if you don't care about the fish, care about the seals. It's all connected. Another thing that we often hear is, animals don't have feelings or intelligence the same as us. Why is their suffering important? So, I mean, this is going to be a little bit controversial to bring up, but the same statement was used in the 1800s as an argument for slavery. Just because they cannot communicate with us in a way we can understand, we have no accurate method of judging their intelligence. All we know is that they are different, as all animals have differences from one another. This does not mean that they deserve less or no respect, nor does it mean that we should take advantage of their trusting natures to exploit them as much as possible, like we commonly do. You guys have anything to add to that?
I think that's a really great, great argument to respond with. But you can also point out, like, what about people that are perceived to have lesser intelligence? Mm-hmm. Like, should we eat those people and kill them because we think they have lesser intelligence?
Exactly.
They're honestly, and okay, so when you're saying the word, quote unquote, intelligence, you're judging by human intelligence. So pigs have been shown to be able to play computer games, which I saw on TV the other day. Some, all newborn baby humans can't play computer games. Does that mean we should eat them, right?
Eat the babies.
Yeah. Intelligence is really just, it's a moot argument, because you cannot judge non-human animal intelligence by the same methods by which we judge human intelligence, just because we can read and write and do math and whatever.
Exactly.
As we were talking about before the show, what about dogs? Like, they're so intuitive in many ways, and as you were saying, they have like
their senses are so much like more in tune than ours are, and
therefore they're more intelligent. Perhaps they can do so much more than
like
we can.
Who's to say what intelligence is? It's such a human thing that we try to judge intelligence based off a set of standards that is not relevant for other species.
Right. I think what matters is that we all have feelings. Mm-hmm. All animals do, and we are all here. Even we're all here to live.
Well, and if we are more intelligent, then why are we using
destroying
that intelligence to destroy the planet? Like, how does that make us more intelligent?
Exactly.
I could go on about this for hours, but we should probably move on to the next question, which I guess we have a little bit of time to discuss. So I don't think I could ever give up dairy. I love cheese and ice cream way too much. So I could talk about this for a while, but I'm more interested to hear your viewpoints on this.
So, okay, first of all, if this person's an omnivore, so don't give up cheese and dairy. Give up everything else first that is exploiting animals, and then see how you feel. You might feel really good. You might feel better. Your mind might be expanded to then take the steps to think about choosing dairy alternatives. Mm-hmm. There's so many out there, actually. I don't feel like you have to give up dairy these days, because instead of drinking cow's milk, you can drink soy milk, almond milk, hemp milk, oat milk, potato milk, flax milk, and there's so many awesome alternative dairy-free cheeses out there too, yogurts and all
and
that.
And the dairy industry is the same as the veal industry, so it does still contribute to killing and a lot of suffering, and it is meant for calves, not humans.
I read a book once too that said it's good to emphasize, like, if this person's already vegetarian, think of all the things they've already given up, and how are you able to do that? Maybe you can
get used
can
to it
take
too,
on
right?
something else.
Yeah.
Too.
Okay, and so you are listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And I have some headlines to tell you guys about. So, first off, British activists seek ban in trade of polar bear parts. Now, this was actually really surprising to me, because I didn't know that polar bears were still being hunted. I don't know if that was kind of a naive portion of me. But anyway, so a life-size sculpture of a polar bear has been unveiled in London as part of a bid to rally politicians in Britain and Europe to back a global trade ban on rugs and other products derived by the iconic Arctic animal. The Canadian government and Inuit communities that rely on income derived from what they consider a sustainable harvest are strongly opposed to the campaign. The issue is coming to a head in advance of a major international meeting that begins March 3rd in Thailand, where delegates from Canada and other signatories of the Convention on Animal International Trade of in Endangered Species of Wild Flora and Fauna are expected to debate the risks of the continued trade in polar bear parts at a time when climate change is seen by some experts as a serious threat to the creature's existence. So, the polar bear listed on Appendix 2 of the CITES Treaty, but proposed for uplisting by the U.S. to the more restrictive Appendix 1 category, was classified as a species of special concern by the federal government in November 2011. That designation prompted by what Environmental Minister Peter Kent called Canada's unique conservation responsibility to protect a Canadian population that represents about two-thirds of the world's estimated 23,000 polar bears, kickstarted a three-year review of management of the species in Canada. So I'm hoping that they can put an end to this hunt, because that's pretty... 23,000 doesn't seem like a lot of polar bears, and they're already listed on the appendix of species of special concern of endangered species, so obviously they are endangered.
The polar bear hunt isn't something you really ever hear about. It's not on my radar. That's
I was quite shocked to even find out that polar bears are being hunted. Like, first of all, their ice caps are melting, so there's not much left for them to begin with, so they're already becoming more endangered, and then we're killing them. Yeah, it seems a little odd to me. Another story, this hit news headlines last week is BCSPCA seizes 45 dogs from Victoria area animal hoarder. So in Victoria, a case of animal hoarding has led the SPCA to remove 45 dogs from a Brentwood Bay home. One of the mixed miniature poodle Bichon Frise dogs was found dead, leaving 35 adults and 9 puppies to be taken into SPCA care. The dogs range from 4 or 5 year olds to puppies born just a few days ago. Now that the dogs are at the SPCA, they have been placed in a number of adjoining kennels while the mothers and puppies have their own room. BCSPCA stressed that no adoptions will be taking place for at least a few weeks while the investigation into the dogs' treatment is investigated. Custody issues regarding the dogs must also be sorted out. So hopefully these dogs do not end up going back to the hoarding household as occasionally
happens. Wow, is that a thing, animal hoarding? I'm shocked right now.
We did a show on it.
Wow.
It was a really, really interesting show, of interview I did about 2 years ago. So people can look that up. Thanks for the news there. Yeah. For our feature interview today, we have author, attorney, and animal advocate Sharon Discorfano on the show to speak about her experiences on coping with the loss of a companion animal, something that many of us have or will experience in this lifetime. After the death of her beloved beagle Pushkin in 2009, Sharon decided to write a letter each day to him during the season of Lent, resulting in a collection of 47 letters and a book that was recently published entitled Letters to Pushkin. The letters document a healing process and form an intimate conversation about life, death, and the afterlife, which we'll be speaking about today. Hello, Sharon, and welcome to the Animal Voices Show.
Hi, Allison. Thanks so much for having me with you today.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show today to speak about a really heavy subject that not all people are open to talking about in public or even at all. We know that death is something that will inevitably affect all of us, especially those who have companion animals, because they are the ones that are always taken away from us so quickly. In your book, Letters to Pushkin, you state that the loss of Pushkin was the first loss of a loved one in your life, and as with any major emotional events in one's life, the first is always the worst because we haven't yet experienced and developed the tools on how to cope with this kind of significant life event. When loss of a loved one hits us, what are the stages of intense emotions that we can expect to experience?
Well, I think, and I certainly was fortunate enough to be older when I did experience this loss, which was my first loss. My grandparents all passed away when I was still about 3 years old. Basically, so I didn't really have anyone close family-wise. Grandparents and then pets are usually the ones that children or, you know, people will experience first. And, with a companion animal, it's still very much the same stages of grief that, you know, we read about, I had read about and learned about earlier in life, the five stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, and that's not linear, right? You kind of skip around as you go mm-hmm. with your emotions and your thought process. But it's very much the same kind of things that you're going through, and even to have learned about them before, as a college student, I'd taken a sociology course on death and dying and learned about these processes. It's a completely different thing to understand it intellectually and then actually go through it. And even though I recognized and I had labels for things I was going through, the emotions are still very real. It's what happens. And there's nothing like the first time, I guess, when you're actually going through it rather than
right.
just reading about it.
Can you talk about the process of grieving and what experiences it brought for yourself that you otherwise wouldn't have expected?
Well, I think that for me, one of the things with companion animals in particular is that they are part of your day-to-day. Mm-hmm. It's like it's an immediate family member. All of a sudden there's that immediate absence that you feel, the silence in the house and just the daily routines are completely disrupted for you and for the other family members. I mean, even our other dogs were noticeably different, kind of looking around, not going on his dog pillows that Pushkin used to use all the time. And so the unexpectedness is just to have that presence ripped away from you. And even if you are reaching out in a more spiritual sense or, trying to feel his presence and he lives on in your memories or he lives on because he lives in your heart, at the end of the day, I remember saying to a friend who was trying to comfort me with these kinds of thoughts and words was, part of me is a mom and I just really just want to be able to scoop him up in my arms.
Of course.
And so I think that's part of just, that whole process of getting used to, definitely Pushkin still has a presence in our house, but it's very different because there's not that physical beagle body running around.
And it's true, wouldn't you say, that time does heal the wounds in your heart?
I think time helps you learn how to carry that grief. I don't know, and plenty of people have said this about their companion animals when they opened up and shared their stories to me, whether they were close friends or strangers via the letterstopushkin.com website, but also human loved ones that people have lost. The loss is still there, and you can't undo that, and it is a part of life. With companion animals, there's at least, you know going in kind of because of their lifespan that there's this impermanence. So I say that they are one of the greatest teachers about that lesson of impermanence of life. But it's still there, and you still miss Pushkin every day. You just find ways to kind of keep him around with me. Right now, I feel like, oh, he's here with me, right mm-hmm. before I started the interview. I'm like, okay, Push, let's go, time to show up for the interview. So there are ways to carry that, and it's constructive, right? It's not getting stuck in the grief. That's the important thing.
Right.
So that life evolves. And I say that the letters allowed me to let my relationship with Pushkin evolve into what it has to be now.
Yeah, so I'd like to talk about that in the process of healing. Can you tell us about the process of the letter writing? How did you go about it? What exactly did it do for you to be able to express your emotions that you were feeling every day for 47 days?
It was an interesting thing. He passed away just a few weeks before Lent began with Ash Wednesday. I was raised in a Catholic household, although I've studied other kinds of religion and philosophy since then. So in the letters, I think that comes through mm-hmm. as well. But the nice thing about Lent is that it's 40 days plus the Holy Week leading up to Easter Sunday. And so it was a finite period. And a lot of times in Lent, people give stuff up, but other times they try to do constructive things, like volunteering at a soup kitchen or things like that. And so it just seemed to me a very natural thing. Okay, I'm going to write a letter a day to him and finish on Easter. So there was this, I gave myself this time to grieve, but knowing that it was going to come to an end, Right. And I still write letters every once in a while to him, but it really was this process and just being really open. And a letter, rather than just a journal entry, seemed very natural because it could be long, it could be short. It was a way to spend time with him, just like I would if he were my kid off in college someplace. I'd write a letter to him. So it seemed a lot less heavy. And also, who would want to get letters from anybody that was just all about crying and weeping? So the letter actually kind of sets the tone where, okay, this is what's going on today, this is what I'm thinking today. And so the emotions are there, and I'm definitely sorting through my emotions and pulling from different things I'm reading and what friends are, offering up as advice and suggestions and their own histories and stories. But, the letter really made it something where it didn't drag me down every day, and it was something that I looked forward to. Most of the time I did it in the morning, but sometimes I would put it off till later in the day if I knew I was going to be meeting up with a friend. I'll be like, oh, I'll write the letter later. This way I can talk to Pushkin about that a little bit.
I would think it's almost like journaling, where you're setting aside a time of the day where you can sort of dump out everything that you're feeling as a culmination of what happened to you that day. And I would think that is very healing in itself. For people who would like to try the letter writing for themselves as a tool for coping with their grief, can you offer some tips and advice? For example, what should they think about writing in their letters to their deceased companion animals?
Right. What I did was on the Letters to Pushkin website, which was created so that people could use letter writing and hopefully find it as helpful as I did. When you go on, it kind of talks you, it offers up some questions that you might think about when you're writing your letter to your loved one. And, the different things like, what are the little things you miss about them, the little quirks that they had, or your favorite memory of them? But also just, in general, what are your feelings about what's happening right now in your life? Just really trying not to always to dwell necessarily on the loss, but to really kind of celebrate those little moments that pop up, if there's something during the day that mm-hmm. reminds you of something that, your animal used to do, or someone says something, those kinds of things.
I think there's a lot of reminiscing, and I think that's healing in itself, is just sort of going over the memories. Would you say that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Definitely going over the memories. I think that with the process of writing a letter each day for the whole season of Lent, life was still going on. And so there were a lot of things that were happening. I had three friends from very different stages of my life just show up kind of in my neighborhood in Arizona. And, you know, I'm a New Yorker. My friends are dispersed now, but definitely not Arizonans. And so for them to show up and for me to be able to share with them and be vulnerable with these people that, you know, I've trusted and they've been around most of my life, I made a decision to get more involved in animal advocacy, and that led to a decision to go to law school to focus on animal law. That was all happening during that time, and so as much as it was about reminiscing, it was also, I would say particularly, the second half of the letters, as it just happened naturally, there was kind of a turning point, actually, about halfway through, where you can see in my words that, okay, I'm finally able to, in my mind and in my heart, put Pushkin in a peaceful and happy place, and that's allowing me to think about what comes next here, never mind what comes after, you know, the afterlife, but for me, what's going to happen now, and what am I going to do with this? And so Pushkin becomes an inspiration that steers me down a completely new path.
So in the book, you speak about many of the special times that you shared with Pushkin, and you state that you never took those experiences for granted, which I think is notable because I feel that when we are spending time with our loved ones on Earth, sometimes perhaps we just don't realize the temporariness of it all, and then perhaps we can have regrets later when they're gone because we feel that we didn't fully cherish those times together as we should have. Can you talk about how a person can learn to actively cherish the times they spend with their companions and family members while they are alive, and speak about the importance of preserving memories?
Absolutely. We were fortunate, I say we, meaning my whole family, in a way, from the very time that I first adopted Pushkin. When I adopted Pushkin, he was heartworm positive, and this wonderful organization, Bidawi, in New York, rescued him, took him in, took care of him. He was quarantined. I met him Thanksgiving weekend and couldn't even bring him home till mid-January because he was undergoing treatments. And so from the very beginning, I had this sense of, you know, every day with Pushkin was a gift, and he was fragile in that way.
So you knew that from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And he was fine in health, I mean, once he was treated for the heartworm. But he had, you know, he had some other issues that came up later on. He lived with cancer for 2 years and led a very healthy life up until the end, and, you know, it was actually kidney failure that got him in the end. So, you know, because we had these things always coming up with him, I think from the very beginning I had the sense that we start the day. I still start it with my other two dogs where I say, another day, another
right,
day.
Right, I love that.
And it's so true. And especially with everyone's animals, we all know that our time with them is limited. You know, whether their lifespan is 10 years or 12 or 15 or maybe if you're lucky, 18, we know that every day with them is a gift, and they're not going to be around forever. And they are definitely on loan, and they are among our greatest blessings. So, you know, animals, by teaching us impermanence or being a reminder of that impermanence in life, I think they are really wonderful at teaching us not to take for granted every day that we have with them, which then translates into our relationships with humans.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know, just really. You know, taking that time, my husband and I actually joke because, you know, in your vows you say, I vow to honor and love and cherish you. And so we don't even say love. Every once in a while we look at each other and we say, I'm cherishing you. I'm cherishing you right this moment. And it's an important lesson for us all to keep in mind. I've been very fortunate that from early on I've had an awareness of that. And, you know, and that even with my own parents, you know, I moved to Arizona from New York for a while specifically because they were still healthy and around, and I wanted to spend time with them while I could.
You also talk a lot about the afterlife in your book and what you've been learning about it from all the literature that you've consulted during your grieving process. So because you've done quite a lot of research in this area, can you tell us what you believe happens to our companion animals, or even humans for that matter, after they have left this earth?
I wish that I had the definitive answer, and
none
of us do, unfortunately.
Pushkin knows, as you stated in your book.
Yes, but it is... you know, one of those things where, for Pushkin, one of the things that the letters was about, really was about to be able to carry on. You know, I was like, I have to kind of bring everything together that I've thought about and you know, come to some kind of idea where I can place him where I know he's happy and he's safe and he's peaceful, and the hope every day, I choose to hope every day that I will see him again. And, you know, I have some friends that really don't think that anything else happens after this. And I say to them, but if you lost a child, wouldn't you every day, you'd wake up and you would hope, even if your voice of reason said, nope, this is it, you'd hope you were wrong. You'd hope that voice of reason was wrong, and you would choose to hope that you are going to see him again. And I usually, even people that really don't, my friends that don't think that there is something, look at me with some kind of recognition about that, you know, like that resonates with them. So with Pushkin, you know, in the book I talk about one time I took him to Dog Beach in San Diego, and I took him to the coastline and looked over the vastness of the ocean, and I said, look at that huge universe, and someday we're going to be a million particles, you know, out there in the universe. And again, when I lost him, then, you know, all of a sudden him becoming millions of particles and melding with the universe wasn't as comforting, because then I want to be able to meet up with him again. And so, you know, I think about him in spirit. I mean, obviously I know his little beagle body is in ashes and it's on our mantle. But it helps me sometimes to still envision him as a beagle. So some days when, particularly like an animal law piece of legislation is coming up, I like to picture him as like the lobbyist up in heaven tugging on St. Francis's, you know, robe, saying, hey, you know, we've got to get this law passed, you know, help the hounds in California. But I also think of him, it's interesting, somebody asked me this, and I don't know why this brings me comfort, but I do picture him still as a beagle, and I would love to think that all of our animals, you know, we think about who could love them more than us, and I think about a place where everyone goes, and I think about particularly children, and children who didn't know love in this lifetime, either weren't loved or didn't have the opportunity to love, and I think what a beautiful place it would be if they could all meet up, our animals and those children, and they could look after each other and care for each other and play with each other until we all show up.
Yeah, someone said online once, I remember this a few years ago, I think on my Facebook, if there aren't any animals in heaven, then what kind of a heaven is it, right? So why did you decide to publish the letters in the book, and can you tell us about how the website started Letters to Pushkin, and that also came out of this, and what people can find there to help cope with their losses?
Sure. Letters to Pushkin. So I wrote my letters, and they were, you know, meant to be private. They're handwritten in a journal. I did find it so helpful that I came out of my home office one day and said to my husband, you know, my husband's very good with computers. That's what he does. And so I said, how difficult would it be to build a website where other people could come online and maybe write a letter to their animal that they've lost? And, you know, with him, he said, no, that's not difficult at all. So I said, okay, you know, I'll write up some content, some guidelines, you know, to help people through the letter writing process, and we'll just put it up. So we did, and that was back in September 2009.
Okay.
And so that the website was there, and just by word of mouth, we've had tens of thousands of visitors. You can choose to write a letter and keep it private. You can just email it to friends and family, or you can share it publicly. And over 200 or 250 have opted to actually share them publicly. So we have letters written to everything from horses to dogs, cats, ferrets, fish, bunnies, so all kinds of animals. And, you know, sometimes people write the letters immediately after their animal has passed, and others were writing to animals that they grew up with when they were children,
right,
that have been gone 20 years. And they're beautiful. Each one is so beautiful, and it's such a growing testament to the role that these animals have in our lives as part of our families. And so that's wonderful. That's beautiful. Over the past 3 years that the website has been active, we also created the Facebook page because on the website people can't comment on the letters because I wanted to keep that a safe space. But we decided to add a Facebook page where people could actually offer each other words of comfort and support, and people are extremely generous and understanding on the Facebook page. It really is a wonderful support site for anyone that's going through loss, especially those people that can't get to a pet loss support group or something wherever they are. And over the last 3 years, people kept asking, can we read, you know, we'd love to read your letters to Pushkin. On the site, I've only published the first letter that I wrote because I wanted the focus of the website to be about others. And, you know, finally, enough requests had come in that I thought about it and, you know, said, well, you know, what good can come of this? You know, people seem to be maybe more comforted by it. If it's in book form, people can give it to someone they know who's going through that loss, which is nice, you know, that those people that might not otherwise find their way to the website to write a letter of their own. And finally, we decided 50%, you know, I talked with my husband about it, and 50% of my royalties goes to Bidawi, which is this organization that's based in New York where I adopted Pushkin. And they are doing amazing work every day, rescuing animals and creating families between animals and humans. So it was just another way to get more good out of my own loss. And so it seemed like the next step.
It's a really beautiful book, and I just encourage all of our listeners to read it. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Sharon, to speak about coping with the loss of a companion animal and your book, Letters to Pushkin. And once again, the website is letterstopushkin.com, where you can go to find out more about Sharon's work and her book. Thank you, and take care.
Well, thank you so much for having me again, Allison, and for helping us spread the word about Letters to Pushkin.
You've been listening to Animal Voices Radio Show on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia. Next week's show will be another freestyle show where we'll be sharing a mishmash of surprise, interesting items and inviting you to call into the show if you wish. We're here at Animal Voices Radio Show, and we modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. You can do so by signing up for our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. Please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. In closing the show today, we're going to end with a song called I'll See You Again by Westlife, in honor of today's show about grieving the loss of a companion animal. Stay tuned now for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith, and thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. Remember to be kind to the animals.
Can't say this to your friends.